I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. My guest is Vanessa Abraham, a certified speech pathologist and acclaimed author. In 1 week, Vanessa went from being a mother, a full-time employee, to being unable to move, eat, or speak, and totally dependent on others for her care and fighting for her life. Here's Vanessa's story.
The topic, speechless, how a speech therapist lost her ability to speak and her silent struggle to reclaim her voice and life. Thank you, Vanessa, for joining me today. And how are you doing?
Thanks for having me here. Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I'm significantly better than I was 6 years ago. 6 years ago is when my medical journey began. So I'm about to celebrate my sixth year anniversary. And I launched a book titled Speechless, as you mentioned. So doing a lot better.
Okay, well, let me take you and our audience back 6 years and a week before what happened to you. Tell us how you were doing 1 week before the situation occurred.
So a week before I became ill, I was doing pretty well for the most part, other than the fact that I was probably working a little too much in a very stressful environment. But health-wise, I was great. I was, thriving as a speech pathologist and mom, and my family and I decided to go pack up and go on a little camping trip, where during that time, I just woke up one day and felt really, really sick and had to come home. And within a week's time, I declined very rapidly to the point of being in the ICU on life support within 7 days.
What brought this about?
You know, nothing really. There was no virus, there was a virus that attacked my brainstem, spinal cord, which we later found out. But at first, I just thought I had a really bad case of the flu or a cold or something that just wasn't getting better. With 3 days later, I started losing my voice, which we found out later that was just a virus paralyzing all the nerves, innervating all of the vocal cords. But there wasn't really something that brought it on. I would like to say it was probably stress, but that's undecided.
Medically, what did your doctors say? Have they been able to conclude what it was that incapacitated you?
Yeah, that took, 3-4 months, maybe 5 months later. But initially, they had all sorts of different diagnoses. They thought initially MS, and then they thought possibly botulism. They thought neuromyelitis optica, NMO. I got a lot of different diagnoses, and then each one they found a reason why it wasn't that. But it wasn't until, 3-4 months later that they finally figured out a diagnosis, which was Guillain-Barré. The thing that made it so difficult to diagnose what I had is because my variant is so rare, and it took a different course. So usually typical Guillain-Barré ascends from the feet up, and mine went the exact opposite. It went from top to descended from top to bottom.
You're in the ICU. Can you take us into your mind and your mindset? What was going through your mind as you were there? What were you thinking about? And just elaborate.
Yeah, my mindset was pure panic. I had a young child at home at the time, and my mindset was thinking that I was never going to see her again. My mindset was that this is the end of life, and I better figure out a way to say my goodbyes, because it was a very scary moment. Nobody knew what was going on. No one knew what my prognosis would be. It was just a big medical mystery. No one knew. Me being a speech pathologist, I also knew that this was not a good situation. Waking up in an ICU room and having a team of medical professionals around you. And at this point in time, I was unable to move my upper body. So, as being a speech pathologist, I knew that this was not good. I had a lot of significant depression and anxiety that was circulating through my mind on a daily basis. Worries, immense worries over my family and what their life was going to be like without me. It was a very depressing and worrisome time.
Minute by minute, second by second, what was getting you through each of these moments? What was it that kept you strong and kept you focused? I know your family, the fact that you were, I would say, struggling for your family, but what was keeping you, going on a minute by minute, second by second, hour by hour basis?
The ICU room that I was in, they decorated with pictures of my family. It was like wallpaper. And when I laid in my bed, unable to move, this wall of images of my family truly is what got me through it. I would lay there in bed, looking at pictures of my child and thinking, I need to get better. She needs a mother. She needs me to be home with her. She's young. I wanted her to know me. And that's truly what got me through it. I didn't want this to be my forever. I didn't want to be the mom that was paralyzed in bed, using assistive forms of technology to communicate. I was using letter boards and my phone text to speech because I was unable to communicate. And I didn't want that to be my future for my child, and I didn't want that for my husband either. So I was very, very motivated to get better, although I was also very scared that my life was ending.
So what was and what is rehabilit what was rehabilitation like? What did you have to do to rehabilitate to get back to where you are now?
Oh, great question. A lot of hard work. Not only, physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, but a lot of mental health therapy. I was very depressed. It was a very depressing period of time for me. I went from a very healthy mom that I would walk miles a day, hike with my daughter on my back, 8,000 foot, 9,000 foot mountains, to be completely unable to move, unable to talk, unable to eat a meal. So it was a very, very depressing time. So a lot of mental health support. I have this thing called PICS, PICS, which is post-intensive care syndrome. It's a lot of the cognitive deficits that we face as ICU survivors. So a lot of anxiety, as I've mentioned many times, and depression. But back to your question too about what rehabilitation was like. It was years. I'm still re rehabilitating. I said, as I said, 6 years later. I still have a lot of neuromuscular weaknesses, but it's been a lot of time in the gym trying to get strong again, trying to learn to move my upper body. A lot of voice and swallowing exercises too, which was a part of the rehabilitation process. Everything in my vocal cords, swallowing muscles, those were all paralyzed, so I was tube fed. So it's been quite a whirlwind of rehabilitation techniques and strategies. I've had, like I said, I've had all sorts of therapies, PT, OT, speech. And as a speech therapist, it's just been unbelievable being on the other side of the table receiving services.
So your background as a speech, a certified speech pathologist came into play?
Oh yes, 100%. Yeah, all my knowledge that I learned in grad school came out big time. But the one thing that I did learn too is that in grad school, we didn't learn about the psychological impact of an ICU stay. I learned all about voice and swallowing disorders and how to treat them. But the mental health side was not addressed in grad school. And that's kind of what I'm talking about heavily these days is trying to get people educated about the mental health effects of an ICU stay and what PICS is, that post-intensive care syndrome.
It would appear that an ICU room is could be at best scary. You're there and machines all around you and nurses and doctors coming in and out. In that ICU room, and you had pictures of your family around you, in your still quiet moments, could you have ever imagined that you would be where you were?
Oh, never, never. I went to be a speech pathologist for different reasons than ever thinking that I was going to be the patient in the bed. I never in my wildest dreams ever imagined that I would be the patient in the bed, waking up one day and having a speech pathologist assess me for voice and swallowing disorders.
Let's talk about the family. You're back with your loved ones and all. Talk about the nurturing effect or the impact of having your family around you as you go through rehabilitation and as you went through your stay in the ICU. Talk about the role and the importance of love, warmth, and family.
Oh, warmth, love, family. I want to tie in the word community. Having a community of people surrounding you during these difficult times, there's nothing that describes how important that community is. People that understand you, people that are there willing to help. It's so valuable because for me, I was unable to get in the shower, I was unable to wash my hair, unable to cook meals, drive. And it's so important to be surrounded by community and that, like you said, the warmth and the love of people that understand you. I've attended weekly support groups for PICC survivors, ICU survivors, and having that community as well has been very, very helpful. My ICU support group, they're not necessarily all within close proximity to me, but they're around the world. But having them and their support and encouragement has been priceless as well.
Well, let's talk about the men and women, doctors and nurses who were surrounding you, who were giving you encouragement, who was telling you everything's going to be okay. Talk a bit about their role in helping you to get to where you are today.
Oh gosh, they were so helpful. In the ICU that I was at, their words of encouragement and their support of not only me, but my husband as well, was just incredible. I had a couple of different experiences that were not as incredible, where the staff wasn't as supportive and encouraging. And that added significant depression and anxiety to both my husband and I. But I was very fortunate. The first ICU that I was in, the staff was incredible. They were giving me spa days, helping me feel more human, addressing my concerns with my child and my family, making it so my parents and my daughter could come and see me in the hospital. They were wonderful and they really truly understood me as a mother, as a wife, and did everything they could to help me mentally and physically.
Let's talk about those who weren't as helpful. You just laid out a great bedside manners type of a scenario there. But talk about the ones who weren't so helpful and encouraging to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I did have that experience too, that there were people that were not so helpful, not so encouraging, and they added to my anxiety. I was very scared. I was tube fed, first of all, and a lot of them didn't know how to use it, how to feed me. They were not very helpful. They were rude, very neglectful. And during those situations, that just adds to patient anxiety, to caregiver anxiety. I was very fortunate that during those situations, my husband was there and he was able to advocate for my needs, and get me what I needed and feed me. But when you're in those situations where the staff is not as helpful and as kind, boy, it sure makes recovery more difficult too, because you're in a heightened state of panic and fear, and you're going through so much trauma that it makes it harder for the body to heal and rest too.
I would add being very frightened and isolated. And it certainly doesn't do anything, as you just mentioned, to encourage health, healing, and a sense of security because you are, to some extent, at the mercy of those particular caregivers. And if they choose to be rude, then if you don't have an advocate, then you're all alone. And that's not a good place to be anywhere under in any situation. Let's talk about how you would. how you're telling this story to audiences in your book or in podcast interviews like this, what are some of the things that you're telling them? I know you mentioned a few minutes ago the fact that the mental health portion is not something that is really perhaps in the academic curriculum. Would that be something that you would advocate for graduate programs to include in speech pathology?
Oh, absolutely. I am very passionate about that now, because when I graduated, and most programs today don't address the psychological impact of what ICU survivors go through. I was recently attending a webinar, and they said they did a lot of research on the brains of an ICU survivor and how our brains, after we leave an ICU setting, almost our brain scans look like a survivor of a traumatic brain injury. And sometimes in more severe cases, it looks like our brain looks like the brain of an individual that has had Alzheimer's disease or dementia, just because of the immense trauma that we have been through trying to survive and fight for our lives. So this is some of the impacts of traumatic events. And ICU stays are very traumatic. I equate it to when I came home from the ICU, I remember looking at my parents and saying, I feel like I just came home from war. So my brain now resembles that of a individual with a traumatic brain injury. And I think that needs to be talked about. I think graduate programs, nursing programs, social workers, you know, OT, PT, speech therapists need to know that after we get out of the ICU, we are not the same person. You know, yes, we have survived something extraordinary, but our brains are altered.
So as we move forward in our conversation, has this experience taught you anything more about yourself that you didn't know previously?
Yes, it's taught me that I am a lot stronger than I ever imagined I could be. I always thought, you know, I'm a pretty strong person. I can go through a lot. You know, went through grad school and parenting and, but it took a lot of strength to be able to get through ICU, learn how to move my limbs again, learn how to talk again, learn how to swallow food again. That is the most scary experience of my life, trying to swallow food and praying to God that you don't choke and die in front of your family. But yeah, I've learned that I'm stronger than, and I can endure a whole lot.
I gather this is the toughest challenge that you've met thus far in life.
Uh-huh. Without a doubt. I thought childbirth was hard and raising a toddler, but nothing compares to having to learn to walk again as a grown adult, eat food, breathe independently of a ventilator, vocalize again, make a sound. That took such strength that I'm not even sure I can articulate how hard that process was.
Going forward, what is next for you? What are some of your plans that you want to do next?
Oh, I want to just keep speaking about PICS and spreading the word, getting it into universities. As I talked before, I want the world to understand post-intensive care syndrome. I want to do more speaking engagements about my book, because the book talks a lot about the importance of community and post-intensive care syndrome and the psychological trauma that we go through as ICU survivors. I have a lot of visions with that pertain to all of that.
So let's talk a bit about your book. You just touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to maybe have you delve a little deeper into it. What was the, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. What was the impetus of writing the book, and what do you want readers to get from your book, and perhaps even academic institutions to pull from your book?
Well, there was a lot of different reasons that I wanted to write it. I felt, for me, going through this journey, I felt very alone. I needed a community. I still need a community. And I felt very alone, very isolated. When I came home from the ICU, I always figured, or I was always thinking, like, how do I now fit into this world? I am a mom. I'm a young mom. I was working. and now I no longer feel like I fit in. So I really wanted this book to give others hope, let them know that they're not alone in their medical journey. Definitely talking about PICCs again, because a lot of people walk out of the ICU and they wonder, well, what is this brain fog that I'm experiencing? Why am I having this anxiety? Why do sounds set me off? Why am I so depressed? Well, there's a term for that, and it's called post-intensive care syndrome. And a lot of people don't know that because it's not talked about. We are in a world today where we're talking heavily about trauma and being trauma-informed therapists. And the concept of post-intensive care syndrome is a trauma, and we're not talking about it because we don't know about it. We don't know that there's this term for it. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Well, with the moments that we have left, I would take you back into the classroom and have you talk a bit about, as a certified speech pathologist, you've worked extensively with students using augmentative communication devices. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So augmentative communication devices help students communicate. They're anywhere from letter boards that have letters of the alphabet on it that they would point to a letter indicating what they wanted, to a more high complex device, high tech, things such as iPads that have apps on it that communicate for them. And what's ironic about that for me is that I was also an AAC or an augmentative communication user. I started out in the ICU communicating with my eyes. So it's called eye gaze. I was looking at words like yes and no on a board to communicate what I needed. And then as I slowly got stronger, I was able to progress to using an alphabet board on a piece of paper where it just had alphabet letters on it. And I would point to words like PAIN, indicating pain. And as I got stronger as a speech pathologist, I knew that there was more complex communication devices out there. So I downloaded text-to-speech on my phone, and I was using text-to-speech. And eventually, thank God, I was able to eventually learn to communicate again verbally. So I've used it all. So I've come full circle as a speech pathologist. I used to, or I still do, help kids with communication and using augmentative communication. And I was also an AAC user myself, so I understand both sides.
With the moments that we have left, what is, and it may be a statement you've already made, what would you say is your take-home message that you'd like to leave listeners with as a result of our conversation today?
Oh gosh, one take home. If you're experiencing critical illness, find a support group. I can't emphasize that enough. Support groups are so critical. There's ICU support groups at Vanderbilt. There's another one back east in Pittsburgh. ICU support groups are so important because you're surrounded by community. You're surrounded by people that understand you. Those have been, my support groups have been a lifesaver for me. And I recommend anybody that's going through or has gone through an ICU stay, even caregivers, loved ones can attend these meetings. There's a thing called PICCF, Post-Intensive Care Syndrome Family, because a lot of times family members go through a lot of traumatic PTSD and have a lot of those type of PTSD symptoms. So there's support out there for you if you're experiencing any of this.
And what would you tell listeners about the power of hope?
Oh, finding hope is one of the hardest things to when you're surviving and you're recovering, finding that hope. And again, I'm going to circle that back into finding those support groups because the support groups gave me hope. I would hear other people's stories and their stories of recovery, and it gave me hope knowing that, wow, this person had what I had, or this person has something even worse, and look at where they are today. It gives you hope and also reminds you that, healing takes time. Rome wasn't built in a day. And it's really important to give your body that time to heal, but Those support groups are so important.
And right inside your home, talk about the love of family.
Oh, the love of family. That's having family around you and the support of family. One of the things too that I learned is that some people will leave your side. And I hope that nobody ever experiences that. I did not experience family leaving my side. My family was there with me. My husband was there in the ICU room with me, advocating for me. Having community and family around you, I was so blessed and so grateful to have my parents. My child was able to basically live with my parents during my recovery journey. That was so wonderful. I was so blessed in that area, knowing that she was in a safe place. And again, too, I was blessed my husband was by my side the whole time.
My guest today has been Vanessa Abraham. She is the author of Speechless: How a Speech Therapist Lost Her Ability to Speak in Her Silent Struggle to Reclaim Her Voice and Life. Thank you so very much, Vanessa, for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.